death. Death isn't the opposite of life. It's the opposite of birth. Did you find that piece of wisdom from New Age teacher Eckhart Tolle helpful? How about this one?
Dying is a human-scaled mystery. And one thing that surely can be said about mysteries is the more you learn about them, the more mysterious they become.
Hi, I'm Rachel Kahn, and that was grief walker Stephen Jenkinson, who you'll hear a lot more of today on The Spirit of Things, on RN and online. Death may be a mystery and a paradox, but up close, it's often just shocking.
I remember getting the phone call because my dad and I weren't at the hospice when she died, so Megan called us, and we rushed over there. And before we went in the room, she just said, "Just so you know, she looks really dead." And she did look really dead, and it was shocking to see her skin so, like, white and pale, and to touch her and for her to be cold and hard and not alive anymore. It was really, really, really bizarre.
That's from My Mother Was, one of the many homemade videos that have popped up on the internet, same as the death cafes that have sprouted in the UK, the US, Switzerland, and Canada, and now here in Australia, bringing people together who want to talk about death. So, does this mean we're finally coming to grips with the Grim Reaper? Not according to Stephen Jenkinson. He's an activist, teacher, author, has master's degrees in theology from Harvard, in social work from the University of Toronto, and he looks a bit like an aging hippie, but doesn't sound like one. He's written Die Wise, a manifesto for sanity and soul. Welcome, Stephen Jenkinson, to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you, ma'am.
Well, it's not often I speak to someone like you, a grief walker, which sounds, frankly, like a full-time job in this world of ours.
Mm-hmm. Could be. There's not a lot of takers, but grief monger is something closer to the day in and day out of it all.
Are you accused of being a grief monger?
No, I answer to it, but of course it's not heavily sought after, so so it's few takers and a lot of off days.
What is it exactly? How would you write down your job description?
You know, grief is one of the most misapprehended of the riches of life, seems to me. It has a very bad PR firm working for it, I think. The gist of it is, of course, that it's an intrusion, and it messes with your day, and it does nothing but take. And if anything was halfway either safe or sane or both, there'd be little or no grief, replaced with what God only knows, but that's the general drift. And, you know, I sound a little flippant on that matter. Quite the contrary. That's what I see day in and day out when I'm just walking around or when I'm working or teaching or so forth.
Well, you've had a film made about your work by Canada's National Film Board, the NFB, much vaunted. So that must have been quite an honor to be so recognized.
Or so misapprehended. I mean, if you're the subject of a documentary film, you barely recognize yourself in the film, which is entirely proper, I have to say, because if you actually, you know, wielded so much authority over what your own life means, it would be unrecognizable to everyone but you, probably, and no merit whatsoever. So it rendered an understanding of what constituted being a grief monger in a grief illiterate time. And it was very valuable to me for that, because I kind of saw myself at a distance and, like most other people, wondered, how did that ever happen? How did I ever come about, you could say?
Well, it's an unusual line of work. As you write in your book, Die Wise, you, quote, spent most of your working life in small rooms with people who were afraid they might be dying. Why did you choose that work?
Do you know, the only proper way to say it is I really didn't choose it at all. It's the old adage about you, who you end up with in life, as a life partner, you know. She chased me for so long that I finally caught her. Something like that. So I don't say that I avoided it for the longest time. I didn't even know there was an occupation called working with people who are dying. So it was not in my purview at all. But somebody prevailed upon me over the space of a couple of years, and and said it enough times it was harder and harder to ignore, though it still wasn't recognizable. And I ended up working with a small group of men who were terrorizing, frankly, the mostly female staff in the hospital, just by virtue of either their deep, deep anger over the fact that people had died on their watch, or the utter inability to practice sadness, which turned out to be the reason I was with them. And they eventually called it sad school when they would come with me every week. And it was supposed to last 6 weeks, lasted 18 months. And that was the beginning of something that I didn't know existed.
You yourself never suffered from fear of death?
You know, this is not really a yes or no question if it's answered honestly. I don't remember ever being poleaxed by it or utterly transfixed by it, as I've heard a number of people who've approached me since. I don't seek it out. I mean, just to be clear, I don't feel victorious or heroic about it. I've seen my own death, given how many dying people I've been with over the years. I've seen my own death in detail by now. And there's no reassurance, there's no comfort that comes with it. It's a familiar thing in some respects, but it's not something I'm seeking or I feel blasé about. Quite the contrary, the more in view it comes, the more I find life habit-forming and entirely worthwhile. I mean, even trying to drive here through snarling traffic this morning, I still found it worthwhile. I didn't remember that then, but I remember it now that it is.
You didn't yourself have a close encounter with death?
Oh, sure.
Apart from today's traffic.
Yes, starting when I was about 3, that's the first one I remember. I ended up with spinal meningitis, which in those days, in their mid-50s, was a terminal arrangement for young kids. I was dying. Not only was I supposed to die, but I remember it very clearly, mainly because I remember how the adults around me were and how they changed from when I was being treated to when I was more or less given up upon. And I don't say that they abandoned me in any way at all, but they did change how they touched me. They were at one point claiming me to stay with them, and at another point recognizing the likelihood of that meager. They touched me with much less claim, you could say. And it was kind, but there was something remote about it, and I remember it clearly. I don't remember feeling abandoned. I just remember the change. And I suppose these things, if life is halfway current in you, never leave you. And it never has. But I never sought to make it into any kind of living. It took until my, mid-40s probably, before I was anywhere close to working with dying people. So either I'd forgotten about it for a long time, or in some respects I was getting ready. Because exposure to dying in and of itself, in a culture that neither readies you nor gives you a language for it, nor believes in it, frankly, is no preparation for anything necessarily at all. So it must have been life, the rest of life, after I nearly died a couple of times. Between the two of them, I had something, apparently, that might be useful in that business.
Well, in fact, you call our culture death-phobic. Hmm. In that we are afraid of death. And I must admit that if I, on the spirit of things, focused on death for too long, people would immediately start thinking there's something wrong with me. I'm morbid or even worse, have some pathological interest in death. But you seem to be saying that our phobia about death is keeping us away from perhaps the most important experience and question we have to address.
Yes, we should say aloud, though, that it doesn't often present itself or is acknowledged as phobia. There's very few people that actually talk openly about being terrorized at the prospect. So what kind of phobia is that that most people don't even recognize as fear? And I think probably if I were to render it again, I would say something in the order of the culture that I'm a product of in North America is fundamentally grief illiterate on the one side and probably addicted to its phobia, rather than phobic per se. And, I mean, this is elaborate, but very quickly, something like this. You know, it is in the nature of addiction that addicted people are very clear about the architecture of their addiction. It's not lost on them at all. And they're also clear about every solution that you or I could possibly offer them. They've already thought about it many times over. Their particular genius, if I could say it this way, the genius of the addiction is that it maintains itself in the act of trying to solve itself. this is how the dominant culture of North America, at least in many places in the West, frankly, are death phobic, because every solution to dying that we come up with preserves the fear of it while claiming to absolve us of it. And the most tender, if you will, and the most vicious rendering of that is the fact that people on the edge of dying are probably the most sedated of any demographic in the population. Now, if everyone knows they're going to die, how to possibly account for all this sedation when it comes? Pain management is one thing, but sedation means get me out of here. I don't want to know about it. I don't want to walk another minute as I have been. I don't want to die, frankly. I think the sedation whispers enormously that the entire arc of our dying time preserves and reiterates our terror of it.
That's interesting. You've mentioned time, and of course, that is what happens when people face a serious illness. They want to buy more time. And as you say, sedation, in a way, extends that time. But it also extends the time of dying.
Well, if you're dying, that is exactly what's extended. But we have to say, though, that when you bargain for more time by rolling the knuckle bones of your fate and going for chemo or radiation, there certainly will be more time. There'll be more time with the children or grandchildren, if you're lucky enough to have those. More time in the park and all the rest. And more dying. And it's a package deal. Alas, nobody in oncology, in my hearing, has ever fessed up to that. Nobody in chaplaincy, nobody in psychology, nobody in accounting in the hospital, nobody fesses up to that. That this is exactly what we're going to deliver, is more opportunity to die. Now, this can cut one of two ways. Either it means more opportunity to learn about it, maybe for the first time, or more opportunity to writhe in its shadow.
You actually argue that one of the problems that North America or Western society has is that it's addicted to a concept of quality of life, that it's, in a sense, a secular religion. Mm-hmm. So this kind of approach to death is, in their minds, an extension of the quality of life?
As long as you begin to recognize that the twin towers, if you will, of the quality of life as it's rendered and understood and pursued, where I come from, is on the one hand, utter autonomy, and on the other hand, utter mastery.
Control.
In other words, if these two things are corrupted, or if there's any consequence upon them visited by dying, then euthanasia begins to look like a very good idea very quickly. So really, the exercise of dominion that we seek over dying, that has become palliative care, where I live at least, is an iteration of this utter, what I've come to call, competence addiction. That there's no iteration of you that should be less than what it is right now. Less able, less agile, less imbued with breath and lucidity and, you know, all the normal things. So you can see the second best option is aging. Well, who votes for that? Oh my God, then all of a sudden it's the 40s, and after your 40s, it doesn't look that great after that. And, you know, we could say this. Where I come from, the proliferation of palliative care services is remarkable. This is no more an indication that we're getting good with dying than the proliferation of old folks' homes is an indicator that we're getting good with aging.
Well, I think he's got a point there. The facilities might be getting better, but what about us? How are we doing? You're on The Spirit of Things with me, Rachel Kahn, and my guest is Stephen Jenkinson, author of Die Wise. Find an article about him on the RN homepage. Palliative has at its root a word, Paul.
Paul, yes.
And that actually has implications for what palliative care is, in your view.
Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately, it's not my view. It's actually the etymology of the word itself. The old Latin root is the verb to shroud or to cloak or to conceal. Hence, pallbearers are carrying the shroud. Hmm? And when a pall falls over the room or over our discussion, it's as if there's something that muffles or restrains or, frankly, hides. So the function of palliative care, if you look in the dictionary today, it means something in the order of comfort giving. The question is, how do you comfort dying people in a culture that does not believe in dying or even in limits or even in endings? How do you do that? And the answer is bound up in the word itself. You keep from them the implications of ending. What does this sound like on the ground? The people in the family room are arguing whether Dad should be told that he's dying. And he's 74, and apparently he has no idea. And the people who are against it because it'll somehow diminish his quality of life, quote unquote. And if you ask them, are you serious? They'll say, well, you can't tell him. It'd kill him. He'd just give up. As if he's not allowed to be dying when he is, you see.
It's symptomatic of a culture that cannot speak about death, that we don't have a language. We're not comfortable speaking about death.
We do have a language. But it's a language in which dying is not recognizable. I've said many times that I'm certain that palliative care and the burgeoning death industry, death cafes, etc., are places where euphemisms go to enjoy a long and healthy shelf life. You see, but dying is not in the vocabulary of dying, in North America at least. So we exercise word voodoo. Instead, we avoid the industrial strength words, especially the single syllable words like die or dead or death. And it's not just the New Age people who traffic in the gauzy synonym. You know, it's all over the place to the point where you cannot really recognize sometimes if people are talking about dying when they are clear that they are.
Stephen, I want to introduce a kind of pushback mm-hmm. here. There might be people who say, look, this palliative care, this extension of my life is giving me an opportunity to reflect on the meaning of my life, prepare for death. Mm. Have you seen that? Do people take those opportunities to put their life in order, as it were?
Well, of course it happens. I could just say this, and I'm not pushing your push, but to deepen what this means. I promise you that I wouldn't have had a job without that death phobia. There'd be nothing for me to do. And I got busier as things went along. So I think maybe the best way to tell you, briefly tell you a story. I'm doing an interview with two young men, and they asked me as follows. They're working on a serum. You may not have heard about it given your age, he says to me. But we know about it, and eventually in my lifetime it could be available. You take the serum, you don't die. I don't know what happens. I didn't ask the details, but you don't die. And he said, my question to you is, what would I miss if I drink the serum? Which is a genius question, okay? Fundamental to being a good North American. What would I miss, you see? I had to meet this genius somehow. And I not only did I praise him, but I said, I don't think that's the question. I think the question is, if you drink the serum and you don't die, what will the rest of us miss? And this is what I'm really pleading for. Some realization that your death is no more your own to do with as you see fit than your life is. That your life is frankly granted to you, obviously by the health of the planet in a global sense, by the food that's a consequence thereof, and by the willingness of your peers and the people around you to grant you your existence and its meanings. Dying inhabits exactly the same degree of mandate for us, that it's entrusted to us, I would say. If you spend your dying time refusing to die, you're reneging on the deal. Nobody says they're refusing to die. What they're doing is being hopeful, eating enough broccoli and thinking good thoughts and whatever else amounts to alleged quality of life. But normally, the quality of life that's exercised, on my watch at least, is the kind that refutes dying, that goes on in spite of dying. And I'm pleading for a quality of life that's a consequence of dying. What I'm pleading for is not something that's a defense against dying. It's something that's informed by dying. It serves dying as a god, if you will.
You write about a Protestant minister who is short of breath and clearly has very few weeks to live, perhaps months, but he insists on giving his sermon to his congregation as if everything is okay, it's heroic, it's stoic, And gosh, reading that made me feel so sad for the congregation, who, in a sense, must witness this denial, something that could be a gift to them.
Indeed. Do you think most of them would have seen it as a denial? The way I told the story, I didn't think so. I think the greater likelihood is that he would be understood to be heroic, which is probably the great poverty of our time, to die heroically. You think of this film, I'm sure it made it down here and made a similar dent on the popular culture, called Bucket List, standard American film in which everybody's heroic and thwarts death until the very unacknowledged end. Well, you know, in all honesty, the spirit of the film was such that the movie should have been called something that rhymes with Bucket List.
I think I can guess.
That's the tone of it. And see, what I'm pleading for is not that kind of defiance, you know. No more than you would defy the presence of your firstborn in your house and not let it change your life substantially. It's the same order of magnitude when you're dying, that it's supposed to alter the, quote, natural order of things to include this now. There's nothing morbid about that. There is something life-affirming about that.
In Grief Walker, you're speaking to a woman. She's lying in bed. She's clearly about to die. And you tell her that she must face her death humanly for her family to go on and live normally. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to face one's death humanly?
It's certainly not me to prescribe what human means, but I could describe it a little bit. One thing would be to be utterly heartbroken, not to be affable and able, but to be heartbroken, to be wrecked on schedule, is an utterly human attribute. And it's not the undoing of your humanity. It's where humanity comes to call. That you wish it were otherwise when you're dying and your kids are teenagers. That you don't agree with it at all, and God knows you don't accept it. Okay? But the alternative is not fighting or fleeing. The alternative is being willing, against all instincts to the contrary, to know it and to proceed in the time allotted to you with your family as if what's happening is happening. And that's what dying is. It's not a metabolic physical event that's cancer-driven and symptomatic. Fundamentally, dying is a human-scaled mystery that has some medical attribute attached to it. And the human-scale mystery is in the order of, what does this ask of me? How might I live as if this is so, or it's true? And then, what's to become of me after I die?
I want to ask you about that because, of course, all these years, at least 20 years you've been working with dying people, you would have encountered people with all sorts of different religious beliefs, Christian, Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, all sorts of
beliefs. Non-aligned.
Non-aligned, of course, and indigenous. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what you have found in your grief walking with people who have spiritual traditions which frame or make sense of their death. Is it any easier for them?
If it is, then their religion is not working for them. In other words, if I could use the generic term belief system, if you have one and you come to your dying time with it more or less intact, do not invoke it as an insurance policy against the realities of dying, which, alas, that's the primary function as I saw it. Largely because most of these beliefs were not crafted with any understanding what dying is, or alongside dying. They were crafted in the absence of dying, and by inference they had something to say about, oh yeah, the dying part. Very few of them, if any, that I know of, with one possible exception, is, you would say, death-centric, whereby the entire affair is understood in part to be a proper understanding of your dying that begins at adolescence, which is the function of initiation, to kill off your childhood. How is that achieved? All cultures that are practicing it, by and large, resort to exposing children to the reality, to the mercy, to the justice, to the meaning and purpose, to the ultimate mandatory or necessary aspect of their life called dying. As children, you know, around puberty, that's what these kids are exposed to. That's how their childhood ends. That's how their capacity for being a human begins. Dying, ironically, the news of your dying, the tuition around your dying, is the thing that gives you a chance to be a village-minded human. They have to be crafted into that, you see. We, on the other hand, where I live, we proceed as if being an adult is an inevitable consequence of whatever your birth certificate says. So we're not in the person-making business at home. And we suffer enormously when we're dying as a consequence.
Isn't that why people come to you and say, I want to find out, I want to make some meaning out of this death? Are they caught between a rock and a hard place trying to make meaning at the end of life?
Probably more, you could characterize as them trying to find it. It becomes something more of a scavenger hunt. If they look in the right place, read the right book, meet the right guru, maybe they have a shot, but at what? At dying well. Look, a death-phobic culture is very familiar with the idea of dying well. It goes like this. The quickest death possible is the best death possible. Okay? It's not that they haven't thought of it. They have, and that's the solution. The less you know about it, the better off you are. Hence the argument about whether dad should be told.
And hence the popularity of euthanasia, or certainly today we're seeing many more people pressing for euthanasia as something of a quick exit from a point at which pain becomes intolerable.
Maybe that's the point at which they request it. I can tell you, having been in the trenches for a long time, rarely, if ever, was euthanasia demanded then. You know, when it's cued by unbearable symptoms. No. Most of the demand for euthanasia as a personal right to exercise as they saw fit when it suited them was invoked in that kind of great intermediate gray zone after treatment, but before last gasps, when everyone had lost track of where in the arc of their life they were because they'd invoked more time, you see. What I'd ask you to consider is that the demand for more time prompts the likelihood of the demand for euthanasia, because the more time is lived, minus any real tuition that came to you during the course of your life about how to live as if you're dying, quote unquote, you see. So you live in spite of the fact that you're dying until the symptoms make this untenable or ridiculous. And then you hope you'll collapse in a heap and there'll be nothing more asked of you. Alas, I would submit to you that where I live at least, we hold a world record. I think we die the longest. And I think the demand for euthanasia is a consequence of that.
Stephen Jenkinson. Here's a view of death that probably does ring true to his ears. It's one of the most famous poems in the English language by Dylan Thomas.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight, and learned too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death, who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
You lived in Kyoto for a while.
I did.
Was the belief in hungry ghosts and ancestor worship and other Eastern beliefs more accepting of death?
Wouldn't that have been something if that were so? But then again, the film Departures would never have been made. Did you see it?
Yes, I did.
Okay, that film never would have been made if what you just asked me was prevailing in Japan. For those who haven't seen it, very briefly, it's a man accepts a job which he thinks is in the travel business only to find out that he's working as an assistant to an embalmer. But the embalmer is an extraordinary man. And there's some deep redemptive vision in the film, even though it characterizes the Japanese phobia, particularly against a dead body and uncleanliness and so forth, very, very attunedly. Where I live, I don't know that there's any peace of mind that's available to anyone by virtue of invoking another cultural practice. It tends to be something they glue on top and it comes loose, you see. So if I could put it this way, the thing that bedevils dying where I live, and to say it in a kind of biblical sounding way, is unto whom shall I die? That means, is there anyone waiting for me? What's to become of me? What became of everyone before me? Is there such a thing as, quote, the dead? Am I joining them? Is it inevitable? What in my life grants me that? Do I have a story even that I've lived by that grants me this understanding as I'm dying? And the answer, generally speaking, is no.
Why? Why doesn't a profound belief that one is going to another place where your ancestors, your departed loved ones are waiting for you, you are about to be embraced by God, by the higher power, by divinity, why isn't that a comfort, a permission to be released from this world?
It probably is. The word you used was beliefs to characterize all of that, and there's lots of those. What I'm saying about them is this. To an item, they're crafted in the absence of the realities of dying, and they cannot really stand up to the realities of dying. Here's an alternative. Not what do you believe about what happens to you after you die, but has your life been lived in such a way that you don't have belief about it, that you bring to bear to thwart the sorrows and the sufferings, but rather, do you have something in the order of a love of life that includes what's happening now? And is it possible that that love grants to you some deep lived understanding of what's to become of you, which is not a belief? It is an earned presence that your life has been deepened by. I would like to distinguish that from belief.
I wonder if that understanding has been enriched by the place that you live, which is the beautiful northwest of Ontario near Nipissing, where three rivers meet. There must be something spiritual about that. You have many friends there amongst the First Nation peoples, the Indigenous people. What have they taught you?
Nothing really. No, I would say you're looking at 300 plus years of acculturation in Ontario. There's nothing about, quote, their Indigenous culture that has survived that onslaught. They haven't done a good job of enduring our presence. So they're, on these matters, basically indistinguishable from us. So if anything, I've learned that there is nothing inevitable in indigenosity that can stand against the kind of viral infection that is death phobia, which is to say that death phobia is not a white man problem. Not at all. It's not a man's problem as opposed to a woman's problem. It doesn't obey that kind of thing. What I'm talking about is what happens when a culture is under severe attack. If it were known to be the large-scale horror show that it actually is, people would be in the streets about it. But they're not, because it's not understood that way. So what I'm talking about is when a culture is in severe disarray, fundamentally, when there's no shared understanding that guides your days, that the default position is you decide what's true. You decide how you want to live. You decide if you want a village-mindedness to accompany you unto your grave. One of the attributes of that disarray is this death phobia that I've been articulating and the grief illiteracy that seems its kind of malignant twin. You find these two things. So, of course, in cultures that are in disarray that are Indigenous, no surprise whatsoever after X amount of missionizing and converting and all the rest, that the attraction of heaven is a kind of dark horse that death phobia rides into town on.
You actually describe an Inuit woman who is being interviewed by a reporter and who's asking her about what is the worst thing that happened to you, and he's expecting her to talk about massacres and death of her people, and she says, TV.
TV.
Because somehow it stopped them from speaking about important things.
Well, it literally stopped the generations being able to speak to each other much more emphatically. She gestures to her young grandchild who's sitting on the floor, and she says, ever since that thing came to town, I speak Inuktitut, and my grandson speaks TV. She meant English, but she called it TV. There's a lot of indigenous people who are, you know, holding on for dear life and trying to speak their language in the presence of their grandchildren who don't understand it, believing as they do that minus that, they might yet be indistinguishable from the rest of us.
Can I ask you something, though, that is about TV and death? Hmm. And it's this irony that the West produces a massive amount of entertainment, quote unquote, that is focused on death, murder and mayhem. Mm. There's an incredible consumption of it. Mm. So what's going on here? There's, on the one hand, this exposure, this need for it. And yet, on the other hand, you're talking about a death phobia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, first of all, the program you're talking about doesn't have a lot of death in it. It has a lot of killing in it. And these are different verbs, no? And there's different consequence, and they register differently upon us, no? The kind of dying that you and I have been talking about here is not really the killing kind. The kind of death we're talking about is that the one you can see coming from a ways off, the one that you actually get a chance to orient yourself towards, or not, as the case may be. No, I think the proliferation of what you're talking about is the cover story. This is going to upset a few people, I'm guessing. But I would submit to you that the proliferation of death cafes, which are now vectoring out over the planet, is not a sign, well, now that we're finally talking about it, things are bound to get better. The question is not, are we talking about it or aren't we? It never is, because a consumer culture knows how to talk about stuff to make it disappear. No. The question is, what are you saying about it when you're quote-unquote talking about it? Are you using the same language that you've used to talk about screwdrivers and investment strategies? Because if you are, with the same understanding of what it's really for, you know, that it's there to protect you, that's why you're talking about it, so it doesn't have to be as bad, etc. Don't be surprised that nothing, utterly nothing changes the more people talk about it. So what I'm trying to do is craft a language, even speaking with you now, wherein the realities of dying appear enough to register as something that is knowable but not much known among us.
I think what you're saying is that we have to accept death and learn to accept it as part of life from a very early stage in our life so that it becomes normal. It's not resisted.
Mm-hmm. No, not in the least am I saying that. No. Look, you know the language of acceptance proliferates now. Okay, of course it does in the other four stages or however many there's alleged to be, denial and all the rest. Okay, we've had this for 50 years, this kind of psychotechnology of what dying should be, these stages. How's it working? I mean, people can talk about these stages. They've never read the book that it comes from. It has market saturation beyond anybody's wildest dreams.
I think you're talking about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Well, I wasn't going to mention her, but okay. That is where the current five stages come from, yes. But these are, quote, alleged psychological realities that frankly articulate a reaction to trauma. And that's what she prescribed, a coping strategy for trauma, which is to say that if this language is in place, including the language of acceptance, what you have is a belief that dying is inherently traumatizing and it must be coped with. I'm asking you to consider that the language of acceptance is a traumatizing thing unto itself. My antidote to that is to say, you're under no obligation to accept that you're dying when you are. This is why a few minutes ago I said something in the order of heartbrokenness, dismay, right? Wishing that it were otherwise. None of these things constitute acceptance as it's normally understood.
Oh, I would have thought it does, but I understand what
you're
saying.
Well, what I'm telling you here is not my opinion, but I actually saw what the language of acceptance did to people. It reduced them.
Right.
You see, it reduced their resistance, quote unquote. It
flatlined their emotional response?
To a certain degree, and it seemed to serve to neutralize everything enough where the nursing notes in the hall could say, patient resting comfortably. You know, here's the question. Do we have an obligation as we're dying to rest comfortably? Is this really the most preferred death if we really start to think about it? The absence of desiring to live many's a person in the death rate I heard, either by professional people or by their families, they were obliged to choose between knowing themselves as living or dying. But they weren't allowed to be both at the same time because it's too confusing for everyone as to what they should want, you see. So as long as you're trying, you're working hard, and you haven't given up, then our love is in order. And as soon as there's question about whether or not you're done, then somehow this is not an act of love, you see. A better way to say it, rather than acceptance, might be something in the order of, if dying were allowed to change everything, it would change our understanding of what it means to love someone who's dying, or to die as someone who loves someone who isn't. It would change that too. Our understanding of love would not resist the realities of dying. It would be informed by them.
To love well is to be informed by the inevitability of death. Reminds me of the marriage vow, till death do us part. You're on RN and Radio Australia. This is The Spirit of Things. Download us onto your mobile using the ABC Radio app. Stephen Jenkinson, you must be very informed by many of the people that you have helped to die. What would be some of the experiences that changed you or people who changed you? And I would imagine that many of those people were also children.
Well, most of the death that I saw was bad, 90%+. And the principal thing that gathered them all together was they were small, individual, unique, inward turning, and utterly hostile to the proposition of a village-mindedness that could have redeemed them. The few good deaths I saw, as you could easily guess, were in some sense public. I don't mean as a display. I mean available. There was no, you know, family and close friends only. Nothing of the kind. Children were deeply involved from infancy. They would be around. They would be obliged to be there, frankly. It's an attribute of bad dying to believe that kids would be inherently traumatized by seeing grandpa with no teeth, drooling, and delirious. But the trauma, of course, amongst children is how we react as adults to grandpa, toothless and drooling. That's where the trauma actually comes from. And I saw it all the time. Kids would climb up into bed with a drooling, incontinent grandfather. Of course, they'd comment. In other words, it registered upon them. And then they look at us, who are maintaining a degree of steady as she goes, and they have to choose between their understanding that something's fundamentally different with this old man they've known all their lives, and the unchangedness amongst the adults around them. And I submit to you, that's where the trauma comes from. So alas, most of what you hear me talking about today, yes, I learned at the deathbed, but I learned in travail. I learned with sorrow. I learned it not seeking it. I learned it wishing it were otherwise then and now. The difference between then and now is I've been able to craft a language wherein my desire to have it be otherwise has been eclipsed a bit by my insistence that it must be otherwise, that it's beyond a right now. It's a moral obligation that we have to the people around us who will be there after our death to die well. Because, frankly, we're in the memory crafting business when we're dying. It's just that it's not our memory we're crafting. It's the memories we are entrusting other people to. That and the kind of death that the people we love will come to, minus us. That's what's at stake in how we die. And that's why the sense of urgency that you hear with virtually everything I say, that's where it actually comes from. And probably that's the gift, the burdensome privilege that they bestowed upon me not seeking it, them not thinking that they've given it.
Those scenes you describe sound like they have taken place in the home, and you've talked about a village-mindedness. So this is in great contrast to the emergency hospital or even to the palliative care institution. Is that where you have done a great deal of your work?
The lion's share of the work that I did was in people's homes, trying to keep them there. And I'm with the belief that if people are in a place that they recognize as familiar, maybe a better outcome can be wrung from this scenario. Alas, what I found in keeping them home is that there's very little in normal North American family life that readies anyone, no matter what the nature of their relationship is and their attachment to each other, readies them to contend with the realities of dying when their family life was lived in the greater context of the death phobia that I've been talking about. Mm. You would reasonably expect that the culture's deep disarray around dying would appear at the bedside in the home just as much as the bedside in the hospital, and you'd be right if you think so. There's no shield, you know, at the front door. The culture's there too. Really, what we're talking about now is an act of cultural redemption in the form of caring for dying people well, not some kind of personal salvation. That's really the distinction I'd like to make, because that's where the deep trouble is to be found. It's in the culturally enforced, endorsed horror show called We Have No Meaning for Dying. We scramble for meaning at the very end, when you're not in best shape to go on a vision quest, if you will.
Indeed. Is that what you teach at the Orphan Wisdom School, which you've established in your farm?
I've said that the school is for elders in training, yes, of any age, because alas, the culture that I come from is not in the elder-making business. It's in the geezer-making business. Elders are to be turned to in moments of real trouble, but that's their function. It's not their identity, see? But I come from an identity-besotted culture where everyone's seeking one or a new one and a new name to go with it, no? And you're never too old to become, you know, running buffalo or something like this. And really, we need Jerry Jones on the corner where I come from. That'll do. If you're an elder, that means that people half your age can simply, by resort to looking at you, that you bear the marks of a reliable life and you become reliable thereby. That life has entrusted itself to you for a while as an elder and you have not blinked on that deal. It's visible. It's not hidden. And kids experience life as somehow inherently trustworthy because you have not been obliged either to succumb or to resist, but you've been midwifed unto your later years by a strange and turbulent and at times achingly gorgeous proposition called still alive.
Well, Stephen, you're still alive, thankfully.
And you too.
But have you conquered your dread or fear or anxiety, perhaps, about death? Can it ever fully be conquered?
I sure hope not. I sure hope not. No, it's not my job to conquer it at all. No, dying is a human-scaled mystery. And one thing that surely can be said about mysteries is the more you learn about them, the more mysterious they become. Learning about mystery deepens it, you see. It doesn't resolve it so you can go on to the next, you know, speed bump of mystery on the highway of your days, your self-determination. So, no, I'm not fine with it. I'm not on the other side of anything. I have a feel of what's coming, and I'm not excited about it. I am, however, a bit lucky that I've been granted a kind of vision of how it could be otherwise at a time when I still had breath, and if I may use the phrase, give a shit, that I could employ to stand in other countries in front of people I don't know and be sorrowed aloud about the way it is. And there seems to be something that people are finding more and more worthy of their time and attention, not their agreement, because I'm not asking them to join a new religion or something. You know, my sorrow, such as it is basically what I have engineered and by what I saw. And I'm just trying to testify to it faithfully.
Nonetheless, do you find a strong response to you?
Strong responses, yes, indeed, of all stripes, of course.
All stripes,
oh,
resistance,
sure.
As well as, oh, sure, acceptance.
Hostility.
And how about here in Australia?
I have only been here about a week, but I must tell you that aside from being a spectacular country to drive through, many of the sorrows that I've been talking about seem recognizable to people here. And their response has been audible. Their gasps have been audible, their gasps of recognition. But also there's some kind of willingness to consider, which is all I'm after, that they don't keep to themselves. I know they're out there. it's been a great privilege, you know, to be here. I never would have assumed that anything I saw in this little corner of Canada could mean anything to anyone anywhere else in the world. And I've been proven consistently, if subtly, wrong on that assumption. And this is my great good fortune and got me till today into this talk with you.
Well, I imagine you paddling your birch bark canoe, perhaps on Lake Nipissing or on one of the rivers. What does that time alone in the beautiful environment there in Northwest Ontario do for you?
This may surprise you, but it doesn't do anything more preferable than sitting here talking with you about these things does. It's another thing of my life that I would never have sought the opportunity to be alone that way. I don't seek it as a respite from being on the road. I love being on the road. I love imagining that something I was burdened and privileged to see could be useful to others, and that I have the chance, you know, because whatever skill I have with the language grants that to me, to appear in other people's midst for a while. I mean, it's an ages-old endeavor that I have. It's vaguely prophetic without the answers. And paddling in a canoe is no more prophetic, frankly, than this great privilege that I've been granted to wonder about these things in the presence of other people or perhaps in their homes or their cars, as we're doing now.
Well, I couldn't help thinking about Willie Nelson singing On the Road Again, and you happen to look a lot like him, so maybe you're the Willie Nelson of grief walking.
I've never really taken that as a compliment, though it seems common enough that people imagine that it must be true.
I meant it that way.
I think he's probably better looking than his pictures, too.
It's been a real privilege speaking to you, and especially hearing that wonderful old Canadian twang. Thank you.
Likewise, a great privilege for me, and I appreciate the invitation.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends.
He certainly has a way with words. He says what he does is sorrow aloud. But his book, Die Wise, is not a wail. It's full of uplifting stories. Stephen Jenkinson from Canada has been my guest. Find out more about him on the RN homepage, where you can also find the Spirit of Things website. The film about Stephen Jenkinson is Grief Walker. And online, he runs the Orphan Wisdom School. He's been on a speaking tour in Australia.
And our way is on the road again. Just can't wait to get on.
I think the Spirit of Things might check out one of those death cafes Stephen mentioned in a future program. If you know of any, tweet me at Spirit of Things. I'm Rachel Kahn, and I plan to live hearty and well and get rid of this croaky voice till next time, when I get to share some of the great people of the world on matters spiritual with you, right here on RN. Love is making music with my friends.